On this 27th day of December 2011 in Chicago, Illinois, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Chapter, Canto 4, Chapter 24, Chanting the Song Sung by Lord Shiva. And we are on text 60. Yatredam vyajyate vishvam. Vishvasmin avabhati yat tatram brahma padam jyotir akasham iva vistritam. Translation: My dear Lord, the impersonal Brahman spreads everywhere like the sunshine or the sky, and that impersonal Brahman which spreads throughout the universe and in which the entire universe is manifested, is you. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In the Vedic literature, it is said that everything is Brahman and nothing else. The whole cosmic manifestation rests on the Brahman effulgence. The impersonalist, however, cannot understand how such a huge cosmic manifestation can rest on a person. Thus, this inconceivable power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is not understood by the impersonalists. Therefore, they are puzzled and always denying that the Absolute Truth is a person. This wrong impression is cleared by Lord Shiva himself, who says that the impersonal Brahman, which is spread all over the universe, is nothing but the Supreme Lord himself. Here it is clearly said that the Lord is spread everywhere, just like the sunshine, by virtue of His Brahman feature. This example is very easy to understand. All the planetary systems are resting upon the sunshine, yet the sunshine and the source of the sunshine are aloof from the planetary manifestations. Similarly, the sky or air is spread everywhere. Air is within a pot, but it also touches filthy places and sanctified places alike. In any case, the sky is uncontaminated. The sunshine also touches filthy places and sanctified places, and both are actually produced by the sun. But in any case, the sun is aloof from all filthy things. Similarly, the Lord exists everywhere. There are pious things and impious things. But in the Shastras, the pious things are described as the front of the Supreme Lord, whereas impious things are described as the back of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the Bhagavad Gita 9.4, the Lord clearly says, Mayatitam idam sarvam jagadavyakta murtina matstani savabhutani nachaham te shavastitaha. By me in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. This verse of the Bhagavad Gita explains that the Lord is spread everywhere by virtue of His Brahman feature. Everything rests in Him, yet He is not there. The conclusion is that without bhakti yoga, without rendering devotional service to the Lord, even an impersonalist cannot understand the Brahma tattva, or the Brahman feature. In the Vedanta Sutra, it is stated, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. This means that Brahman, Paramatma, or Parabrahman should be understood. In Srimad Bhagavatam also, the Absolute Truth is described as the one without a second. But He is realized in three features: impersonal Brahman, localized Paramatma, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the ultimate issue. And in this verse, Lord Shiva confirms that ultimately the Absolute Truth is a person. He, Shiva, clearly says, Tattvam brahma param jyotir akasham iva vistritam. Here is a common example. A successful businessman may have many factories and offices, and everything rests on his order. If someone says that the entire business rests on such and such a person, it does not mean that the person is bearing all the factories and offices on his head. Rather, it is understood that by his brain or his energetic expansion, the business is running without interruption. Similarly, it is the brain and energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that carry on the complete manifestation of the material and spiritual worlds. The philosophy of monism, explained here very clearly, adjusts itself to the fact that the supreme source of all energy is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. This is described very clearly. It is also stated how the impersonal feature of Krishna can be understood. Vasoham apsukuntaya prabhasmi shasisuryayo pranabhak sarvavedeshu shabdakke paurushan rishu. O son of Kunti, Arjuna, I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and moon, the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. I am the sound in ether and ability in man. Bhagavad Gita 7.8. In this way, Krishna can be understood as the mystic power in everything. Om Jnana Tavarandasya Jnana Shalakaya Chukshurun Vidatam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torch of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So I remember one of the first things that you're taught when you come into the temple community, which I did many years ago, Henry Street, Brooklyn. You're not that body, Prabhu. You're pure spirit soul. And then you learn a phrase, Aham Brahmasmi. Aham Brahmasmi means I am Brahman, means I am spirit. And from that phrase, we can intuit some of the inconceivable qualities of Krishna as well. Because I am Brahman, but we know intrinsically that we are persons, isn't it? We're persons, we're individuals, we have form, we have qualities, we have activities, we have individuality, all sorts of varieties. And yet, we're spirit, pure spirit. We're not this body. The body is simply a tool, a covering on the pure spirit soul. And it's constantly changing, whereas the spirit doesn't change. That's the first thing you learn in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Avyakto yama chintyam avikarya yamuchate. Avikarya means it doesn't change. There's no passing away of qualities, there's no old age, no disease, no death for the spirit. So here in this prayer, this wonderful song of Lord Shiva, he's mentioning in this text about Krishna's inconceivable oneness and difference. And the Brahman spreads everywhere, this light, this pure spiritual light, which we cannot see with our present eyes. We can only see material light and material reflection. But this Brahman, and this is one of the themes that you find in Prabhupada's purports, is ultimately rests on a person. As Krishna says, Brahmanohi pratishtaham, that this Brahman, fulgence, rests on me. I am the basis of it. And he would often quote from the Isha Upanishad, Hiranmayena patte na satyasyapi tam mukham tat tat pushma pavanu satyadamaya drishtiye. Hiranmayena patte means the golden effulgence. Please remove that effulgence so that I can see your face, your beautiful face. Face means person. So even in the Isha Upanishad, Upanishads tend to deal more with Brahman, with impersonal realization. But this particular Upanishad, Isha Upanishad, is focused on the Supreme Person. But it doesn't neglect the Brahman aspect either. In the Brahma Samhita, we find that famous verse. This is Lord Brahma speaking, and he's the most learned in all the universe. He's the head of the whole Sampradaya. He was enlightened personally by Krishna. And he says, Yasya prabha prabhavato jagadanda koti koti svashesha vasudadi vabhuti bhinnam. Tad Brahma Nishkalam Anantam Ashesha Bhutam Govinda Mahadi Purusham Tamahamajam. So I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, whose bodily effulgence, Yasya Baba, is this Brahman. And that Brahman also manifests all of different varieties of planets with all their infinite varieties of things and persons and bodies and everything. But the basis is Krishna. So, now Prabhupada mentions how the impersonalists can never understand that. If one is not accepting the personality of Godhead, then he remains hidden behind that Brahman. And the same thing is true for the material scientists. They don't see the Brahman, but they get absorbed in the material energy, which is also covering Krishna's form. And they think that that's all there is. Isn't it? They think that everything can be explained according to the workings of this material energy. Getting finer and finer. I read yesterday an article about how they're getting close. They're moving toward the idea of robots who have ethics, who have morality. Right and wrong. They haven't got it yet. And this is foolish. They have, you know, this thing called artificial intelligence. You know. But really, this is a sky flower. You know, this is never to be achieved. Because the machine that you create, the robot, it may have a computer in it, and they get more and more advanced in their computers, and they can think more and more, right? Compute, they can make more finer and finer computations. But no matter how much you manipulate the material energy, and how powerful you make your chip and your computers, you can never duplicate a spirit soul. That's where the person is. Everything else is simply an outer covering. Now our body is a machine, right? Krishna says, yantra rudani maya, that in this 18th chapter, the living entity is in the heart, and so is the super soul. And the living entity is riding on this machine made in the material energy, from body to body to body. So this machine is all that the scientists can look at. And they observe the brain, right? They look at they get finer and finer. They build up more and more information about how the brain works, and they're thinking that the brain is the source of consciousness. And one of the reasons they think so is because they can manipulate that consciousness or that self awareness. You give this chemical called drugs or pharmaceuticals, and the person perks up and feels happy. You give another drug, and they fall asleep, right? So what's happening? They're changing the brain chemistry a little bit. And so by this, they're thinking that this is the source of consciousness, their illusion. And so whether you're an impersonalist who cannot see the form of Krishna because you're averse to service, or you're a material scientist who cannot even see spirit because you're deep in the modes of passion and ignorance, and all you can see is matter, Krishna remains hidden to both. One verse that Prabhupada would often quote from Brahma's prayers. Now, Lord Brahma, of course, is a great devotee, but he was bewildered by the will of Krishna in order to perform certain pastimes in his Brahma Vimohan Leela. And Lord Brahma, he was, of course, a devotee of Krishna, but he couldn't conceive of in his brain, even though he had four brains, and even though he's the... He's the original learned person in the universe. He couldn't compute how this little child in Vrindavan, standing there with 6 years old, standing with a flute tucked in his waistband, holding a little yogurt and going out and playing with the calves, that this could be the Narayan who's his father, that he could be the source of everything. So he wanted to test his claim. And so he put Krishna's calves and his coward boyfriends under a mystic slumber. He stole them away to see what would happen. He challenged Krishna's powers. And you know the result, hopefully. And that is that Krishna manifested an equal set of calves and boys and exactly matched all of their, everyone's an individual, the way they would dress, their different personalities, the way they would speak and everything. And then he went back home, and it just for a whole year, he just kept doing what was going on before. But there was a difference. The difference was that Vrindavan, which is already an ocean of love for Krishna, it just overflowed, even more so. The cows for their calves and the mothers for their sons, their affection increased and increased and increased more. And Balaram was wondering, what's going on here? You know, Krishna was even able to keep a secret from Balaram. This doesn't seem right. And after a year, Krishna explained to him what was going on. And of course, Krishna does many things at once. He was bringing Brahma into the humble position. That was important. But he was also giving these cows and the mothers a chance to intimately serve him, suckle him, and so forth. So this was out of his mercy. So after that whole year, which was a moment in Brahma's time, he came back and he saw, what's going on? I put those calves and boys into his mystic slumber, and here they are. Krishna's playing with them. That doesn't make any sense. And so this is his bewilderment. He's bewildered. And then suddenly Krishna, all those calves and boys turned into Vishnu forms, and they would be decked with tulsi manjari garlands and all kinds of ornaments and beautiful clothes. And all the living beings, they were worshipping those thousands and thousands of Vishnu forms. And so Brahma just became stunned, jada. Now he's really bewildered. He doesn't understand what's going on. So with tears in his eyes, he bows down with his foreheads and gets up and bows down, and then he starts offering these prayers. And among those prayers is this one that Prabhupada would often quote in reference to this covering of the reality of Krishna. And he said, Atapite deva padamba jadvaya prasada leshanu vita evihi janati tattvam bhagavan mahimnon nachandi eko pichadam vichinvan. Now this word vichinvan is translated in different ways. One is, you may study the Vedas for a long time. Chidam means for a long time. Or you may just speculate and cogitate and puzzle for many, many lifetimes. But without at least a little drop of the mercy of Krishna, you cannot understand his true glory. This is the idea. And Brahma is speaking about himself. He tried to understand Krishna with his intellect. But he couldn't. He was bewildered. What to speak of the out-and-out impersonalists who don't even accept the personality of Godhead or the materialists. So the point is that Krishna is completely independent. He reveals himself to those who he feels are worthy. And how do you become worthy? By service and surrender and prayer and glorification, the process of bhakti. Atakshi Krishna namari nabhavai grayam indriyai. That with these senses, these present covered senses, we cannot perceive the reality of the name, form, qualities, etc. of Krishna. They seem material to us, you know. The name seems like a sound, you know, and the whole spiritual nature is a mystery in our present state. So, in order to begin to understand, sevan mukhe hi jivado svayam eva spurajada, one needs to adopt the practice of service, humble service. Casting away, as Brahma says in the previous prayer, jnane piyasam, your efforts to know on your own, by your own teeny brains and our senses, even if you're very learned, even if you live a million years or more, has to be cast away. And you have to surrender. Namanta eva. Sanmukaritam bhavadiya vartam. And listen to the news. You know, vartam is like gospel. It means the talks, the descriptions. Emanating from the mouth of the pure devotees. Sanmukaritam. Not from any source, but from the devotee source. Then you can hear, and it will have that potency. And you serve these vibrations. You don't have to take sannyas, you don't have to change your position, stani stita, but shuddhigatam, follow this path of hearing, and not just superficially, tonovan manobir, means you have to serve these vibrations with your body, with your words, with your mind. You have to listen carefully, you have to think about them, and you have to execute the orders, and serve, in other words, become a devotee. And if you do that, then Jipraya so ajita jito, you can conquer the unconquerable Lord. How is that possible? Just like Mother Yashoda conquered the unconquerable Lord. He's only conquered by love. He's conquered by bhakti, not by anything else. So he reveals himself proportionally to our development of our original affection and loving devotion for him. And that's the only way to know him. He makes it very clear in Bhagavad Gita, Bhaktya Mama Bijanati Yavanjishchatma Tattvataha. To know Krishna in truth, that word tattva is very key, isn't it? Because people know Krishna. You go to India, everywhere Krishna's everywhere. There's the Krishna bicycle shop, the Krishna travel agency, right? Krishna, oh, I know Krishna. You know? No. You know, what was it? What's that story? Correct me if I get it wrong. So there's a neophyte devotee was questioning his spiritual master. Spiritual master would give him the holy name. This is a very special mantra, you know. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. Special jewel, the most valuable mantra. You know, it has all potencies. So the neophyte devotee was chanting, and then he went out, you know, to do some duties, and he found, wait a minute. I'm seeing that the rickshaw wala is also chanting Krishna Krishna, and there's the lady who's pounding her rice. She's also chanting Krishna Krishna. I mean, what's so special about this mantra? You know, I don't understand. So he goes back to his guru and he says, "Okay, you take this jewel. He had a nice ruby or something, and you say now you offer it to those different people and see what they say." And so. He went to the rickshaw wala, and he said, "Oh, I have this jewel. If I gave it, what would you do with it if I gave it to you?" He said, "Oh, I would simply put it on my rickshaw, and it would be a good advertisement or something like that." In other words, he didn't even understand the value of the jewel. And the lady who's pounding the rice said, "Oh, this is a nice big rock. I'll just use it to pound the rice and get more rice out." You know, and there was another one. It was a child who, you know, didn't understand it. Just going to play with it. So the point is that even though anyone could chant Krishna's name, right? That's not really the name. To chant the Shuddha Nam, the pure name, and to really have and appreciate, and Krishna reveals the real significance of the name and the meaning and import of it. That's not so easy. One has to chant without offenses, and purely, and in the right mood. In other words, in devotion. So that's what Krishna is looking for. That's where the prasad will come. He will reciprocate exactly in proportion to our surrender and our devotion. And then we can perceive how all of the... We can perceive all of the elements of the Krishna tattva, which are these three, this Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. We can understand how the Brahman is simply the rays of Krishna's body. We can understand how the Paramatma is simply expansion of Krishna. And then we can also understand Bhagavan. Otherwise, we can, if we don't approach through bhakti, then we may think that the lower understanding, the Brahman, is the final. That's the ultimate expression of the absolute truth, like the impersonalist. And they concoct some philosophy that Krishna is an expansion of Brahma. You see? I had a direct experience of that. Before I came to the temple, I was visiting the Ramakrishna Mission in New York. It's an interesting experience because I actually saw Nikalananda Swami. Nikalananda, who Prabhupada met. He was one of the uptown Swamis who were trying to convince Prabhupada, "Don't emphasize these four regs so much. Maybe you can wear a Western suit." And sure enough, when I saw him, he had a Western suit on. But he had already had a stroke by that time. This was 1972. And his replacement was there in this uptown mission. They had a nice established place. They'd been there since the early 20th century. And this gentleman was a real yogi. He had spent time in the Himalayas. But he was part of the mission, and he was came to New York to carry on. So he had some mystic powers. He was able to tell me some things about myself I didn't tell him, and I was totally blown away by that. You know, here's where you work. You work in a hospital, don't you? I said, "Well," so that impressed me, and I, you know, started learning. And he also gave Bhagavad Gita classes. You know, he was good at speaking, but I was impressed with that. Anyway, so I got involved. And he exactly, you know, spoke just like Prabhupada was talking. When I mentioned, eventually I started going down to the Hare Krishna temple also, and I told him about that. He said, oh, that bhakti? Bhakti is for the emotional masses, you know? Yeah. If you need a form to meditate on, you can meditate on Krishna, or any form is okay. But the real thing is jnana. It's gyan. It was just like that. It's right out of the books. You know? Direct experience. So I was under his sway. And there was great danger there for me, but I was protected. What happened was that Gaur Purnima rolled around. And I think devotees had some kind of festival out in the park or something, which I really liked because I was chanting and I was very impressed, so I actually went back to him and told him about it. And he was very critical. He started being critical of the devotees because he saw I was getting attracted. He wanted me to be his disciple. But fortunately, instead of breaking my attachment for the devotees, it broke my attachment for him. I shied away because I saw the difference. And by that time, I was reading, a Krishna book, a TLC, so I was saved. I had already bought Nikalananda's translation of the Sharirika Bhashya, and I had it in my home. You know, Lord Chaitanya says, "Maya fadi bhashya shunle hoy sarvanash." That if you hear or read the Mayavadi commentary, then everything is destroyed. You know, but luckily I was saved. I never opened it. I never read it. But I had that direct experience. Now here's someone, you know, who practiced yoga. He was austere. He was very intelligent, and but he was absolutely convinced that bhakti was a lesser means, that Krishna was an expansion of the Brahman effulgence. And it was very telling. There's one other vignette from this time, because I was chanting, and I was, I'd go to this center that they had, and there was no pictures of Krishna, you know, and although they had a huge mural of Ramakrishna, but no pictures of Krishna. And so I said, is there some murti or something I can chant with? He said, oh yes, we have something way up on the third floor. You know, we have something you can chant up there. So I went up there, and it was this little room, and I started chanting, and they had one of these little white, maybe it was ivory or alabaster, forms of Krishna standing, you know, with threefold bending form with a flute, just alone, without Radha, in the middle of this table. And so I chanted maybe one or two rounds there. And then I looked closer, and I saw there's like this much dust. You know, there was no devotion there. It was just a murti. There's no sense of that, you know, to even clean the place. So this was indicative of their illusion that the real thing is Brahman. Merge it to the Brahman. You know? So devotees are saved by this from this devouring mouth of impersonalism by Lord Chaitanya and his followers. What is that? Kaivalyam, Kaivalya Nistarako, isn't it? In the songs of the Goswamis. By Govinda Ganamritai, they're pouring down all these songs about Govinda. In this way, relieving the severe misery, threefold miseries, and saving us from the devouring mouth of impersonal philosophy. And you read the Chaitanya Charitamrita several times. Lord Chaitanya meets the impersonalists. Well, most famously, Prakashananda Saraswati, then Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. And he's always victorious. You know, this is Krishna himself in the form of Lord Chaitanya, great pundit, intellect, you know, and he revealed that aspect of his personality. And he explains the Brahma Sutras, they're really about bhakti. They're not about the impersonal Brahma. And so this, how to understand, well, we can't understand with our intellect, but Krishna is giving us some hints. Just as the air spreads everywhere within the sky, right? Mayatatamidam savam jagadavyaktamurtina. The avyaktamurtina means invisible. We cannot see the Brahman. We can't see Paramatma. We can't see Krishna. It's beyond the range of our material. But he's there. Matstani savabhutani nachandeshavasa. So all of us are within that Brahman, but Krishna is separate. His personality is separate. So this is inconceivable. You know, how can Krishna be within everything and everything be within Krishna? This is the vision of the great devotees. Right? Yo mam pashyati sarvata sarvam cha mai pashyati. They see everything within me and I'm in everything. You know? If something is
If the water's in the pot isn't in the water. The same pot is not in the water. You can't. But with Krishna, you can do that. He does that. So, we don't spend too much time wondering about Brahman. But we should know the tattva. You know, these different aspects of Krishna. Krishna reveals himself according to how we approach him. To the impersonalists, he'll reveal the Brahman. To the yogis, he'll reveal the Paramatma. But to the devotees, he'll reveal Bhagavan, and that includes the Paramatma and Brahman. And so the wonderful thing about bhakti, yoga, is that we leave it up to Krishna. We just try to be humble servants, do our best to chant the holy name with bringing as much humility and attention and devotion as we can bring, become well versed in the Shastra, follow the instructions of our acharyas, and Krishna will take care of the rest. He will reveal himself when the time is right. He'll reveal who we are when the time is right. You know, what is our actual form in the spiritual world? How are we to relate to Krishna? You know, that will also be revealed. So we don't artificially try to imagine that we're seeing this or seeing that. We simply follow the process as it's given, and through the transcendental sound, everything is revealed. That's the key, the transcendental sound. So, are there any discussion on these points? Maharaj? Do we need the mic? I guess we do. Acoustics here are a little difficult. And of course, there are also these, you know, so many now, these near-death experiences where people float up to the top of the, you know, the hospital room, and the brain is not working, you know, it's flatlining. And they're working like crazy, you know, the paddles are out, you know. And some people, you know, they survive that, right? Obviously, otherwise they couldn't tell. And they describe, who came in, who did what. Well, who was watching? Where was the brain activity? Where was the eyes? Where was the soul? Obviously, can exist apart from the person. Can exist apart from the body.
What do they do with all this information? They just throw it out.
I don't know. They have various theories and explanations that they try. I guess they try to convince themselves that that it's true. That somehow I don't know. The brain, something was working. Or they were guessing, I don't know. There's so many, and then Ian Stevenson did so many, so much research on kids in India who seemed to remember their previous lives and checked it out, and they had information they couldn't have had. There's plenty of empirical evidence for the existence of the soul. But because it's so... revolutionary, it's so disturbing because it changes everything. You know, in other words, it changes who we think we are and what we have to do. If I live beyond the body, then I have to worry about what body am I going to get? You know, then the whole idea of karma has to come in, and before long they have to read the Bhagavad Gita and understand, and that they don't want to do. Huh? Right. So, anything else, Maharaj?
Well, I was just thinking another point. It just came up in my mind when you were talking, how they use the theory
Yeah.
But a computer. But yeah, you have to think, what is the computer? Computer also has a power source that's separate from the computer. It's like either a battery or some electrical source.
Right.
So that, in the same way, if you just use that same example with the body, there has to be some power source that's separate from the actual activity of the different aspects of the body. What is that power source? They don't even question.
Yeah.
I think that just the combination of materials, we have a power source, but where do you find that anywhere?
And the thing is, there's so much, you know, like the feeling of love and fear, or any of these things. How are you going to program? You can program a computer to show as if he's afraid, or to hug you, you know. But where's the love? There's no love. There's no fear there, you know. In other words, the actual experiences that we have cannot be duplicated by any kind of machine, because there's no person there. There's no soul. This is brought out in that Origins magazine. You know, but the problem is, just as, you know, we're living in a world in which we take the artificial things to be true. You know, all the entertainment and all the movies and all these different things, they try to present, it's a shadow of a shadow, you know. but still, we're taking that as real. You know, we're assuming that's real. So we take that same thing and we put it to the robots and so forth. You know what I'm saying? But when you boil it all down, it's just a dream upon a dream. The reality is not there, you know. And so when we say, like Prabhupada quoted this for Atato Brahma Jigyasa, right? That human life is meant for inquiring into Brahman. Well, that Brahman is the spirit, is the reality underlying all of this phantasmagoria called the material world. That's what we have to look into. Now, ultimately, that Brahman, we know, is the Supreme Person. And we are also persons. But to reach that conclusion and to have that revelation requires a process of yoga. Otherwise, you get completely bewildered by the phantasmagoria of the material world. And you come up with these ideas, you know, that ultimately we're just machines.
In the, I think it's the second canto, second chapter, verse 39, Prabhupada gives a very, very long purport on how to empirically understand it, not just body.
Yeah.
Using the idea of the seeing and the seer.
Right. Yeah. With a little use of the intelligence, right,
that
comes up, one can understand that there's a person, there's a super soul who's giving you the intelligence and that you're not the body. Very famous purport. Yeah, it's wonderful. Okay, you had something. Let's Maharaj, you have one.
I find your explanation for the verse is very interesting. There's, in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says in one of the purports that when a devotee comes to Krishna consciousness, his millions of lifetimes spent in the person of God can become an obstacle in the execution of his devotional service. Can't think of those swords, but it's
a good chapter.
What? So in other words, we have this impersonal tendencies, and they can sometimes be impediments even when we take the bhakti.
And so, you know, we're here chanting the holy name, trying to understand that the holy name is not different from Krishna. But we have these impersonal tendencies. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on how the holy name works to remove the impersonalities within us.
Well, yes. I mean, this is why, you know, chanting the holy name, of course, chanting the holy name is sufficient. Is Purna Shuddha Nitya Mukta. But we have so many other aspects of bhakti that support that and help us to realize the personality of Godhead. And one of the most important things is that, all right, we relate to the guru, we relate to the other devotees in a personal way. In other words, to combat the impersonal tendencies, everything about the process is personal, you know, when you think about it. Everywhere you look, there's personality. And I often reflect upon this, how the bhakti yoga and the science of that we're taught here from the Vedic literature it encourages us to see personality everywhere. Just like Prabhupada quoted, Vaso Homo Sukhen Akonteya. So here's water. There's no person there. Oh, wait a minute, it's not just water. It's Krishna. Or the taste of water. You see? In other words, behind everything, to connect everything that we experience and we see to the Supreme Person. And at the same time, to deal with everything and everyone in a personal way. Like if we're assigned to clean the stairway, you know? So what's our consciousness going to be when we clean that stairway? You know? It should be that, okay, I'm doing this to please my authorities as a person, I'm doing it to please Krishna. You think of the personality of Krishna smiling at you. It's not just, you're not getting paid. It's not just a business transaction. So this is a personal service. It's as personal, Prabhupada said, as addressing the deities. So everywhere, at every step, there's personality. It's a training of the mind. Because we very, very easily fall back into the mood of it's, you know, it's just me and the material energy, you know, and whatever I can enjoy from it, you know. But no, the ideal is that in every breath, kayena vacha manasendriyava, there's a verse in the Navi Yogendras, the teachings of the Navi Yogendras, that everything we do with the body, the mind, the senses, you know, every breath, I should think, oh, this is an offering to Narayan. You know, yat karoshi yat ashnasi. So the chanting of the holy name, when it continues throughout, at every moment we're meant to, you know, remember Krishna, the form of Krishna, the personality of Krishna. Nothing is impersonal. You know, the very walls, everything that we perceive, is Krishna's, and it's also made of Krishna's energy, and he's also there as the super soul. Now, it's just the opposite of the scientists, the reductionist scientists, who are ready to take the personality right out of the persons. We're not persons. We're just conglomerations of chemicals and energies, you know. This is the ultimate thing. The behaviors. You know, I actually heard that. I saw one debate between, it was a Christian guy and a scientist, or an atheist. And the Christian gave some good arguments. I can share maybe at a different time. For the existence of God, you know. But the atheist was saying, ultimately, you know, there's nothing. We're just, I think this horrible phrase yet, but we're just slime on a planet. You know, we just happen to be, you know, we have consciousness, but we're no different than just anything else. You know? What kind of consciousness is that? That's where it leads. This is called reductionism. You reduce everything, as Krishna says. Jagadish, what is that? Asatyam apatishtam te jagadahu anishwaram aparaspatasam bhuktam kimanya kamahaitikam. What else is it? Besides just the attraction and repulsion of atoms and molecules and protons. You show me where there's anything else. You know? You want to know where your consciousness is? I'll get into your neurons and look for your, you know, that's where your consciousness is. They believe that. You know, and they live their life. That's why, you know, they have these guys sitting in a room somewhere moving the drones and they're, you know, about 10,000 miles away. They're bombing wedding parties. Oh, sorry, you know. No remorse, no empathy, no sympathy, no nothing. This is what the result of it is. The horrible works meant to destroy the world. This is a demonic mentality. That's why Prabhupada was so adamant to combat these impersonal scientists who were trying to say, no, life comes from matter. You know, ultimately, that's all we are. You know? But no, life comes from life, and ultimately, everything relates to a person. There's a person behind everything. So as devotees, this is our training, you know, to get rid of this impersonal tendency. And not, you know, at every moment, at every step, oh, this is a personal service to Krishna. This is his energy, you know. Yes, Maharaj? Yeah. Yeah. So what's the harm?
Yeah, what's the harm? That's true.
The harm is that when you are in this material world and you're dealing with so many eternal spirit souls who won't be killed, but they're in a state of consciousness in which they're experiencing pain, although ultimately it's an illusion, but the experience is one of pain, and suffering due to your activities. In other words, you can only kill and not be affected if you do it completely free of false ego. This is in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. You may act, as encouraging Arjuna to fight. If you leave the battlefield, you're incurring sin. You'll suffer. If you stay on the battlefield and kill thousands of the enemy, you won't be incurring sin because you're doing it on my order. Now, these guys with the drones, they're not doing it on Krishna's order, you know. And they're completely in the, doing it out of false ego, false sense of self. I'm a soldier, I'm this, I'm that, whatever. So the point is, the harm is that the people you're killing, they're suffering. You know, they're not dying in any high state of consciousness. They're terrorized. You're causing that. And you're doing it out of false ego. So they're suffering and you're going to suffer the karma from that. You know. So that's the harm. And we're living in this material world, and we have to, you know, observe the rules and regulations that are set down by Krishna of how to interact with others of all kinds, with the realized souls, with the conditioned souls, with those who are inimical. You know, there's a whole way of interacting. If we don't do that, then we'll be offending Krishna. We'll suffer from that. So even though it's ultimately all a dream, you know, and nobody dies, because we're in the dream, we have to deal with it such a way properly so that we can get out of it and help others to get out. All right, how late can we go? You want to? Another minute or so. Okay. Go ahead. But we need the mic. And try to speak slowly because your accent is tough for me in the acoustics.
Okay. I have two questions. One is aspect regarding the Brahman.
Brahman.
Like the impersonalist, they go up to Brahman, means up to impersonalist. Then they merge into that, they become the particles of that Brahman race.
Yeah, okay. The impersonalist.
Yeah, they cannot enter into the real.
No.
The spiritual sky. My question is, what happens to them? What type of mukti or the liberation they get?
They generally, I mean, my understanding is that they really can't sustain that forever. We find in this famous verse in the second chapter, 10th canto, Yen ye adavindaksha vimukta mayanas triyasta bhavad avishuddha buddhaya adua kuchena padam padam tata patantyadho anadisha yushiranmiya. See, it's unnatural for the soul to just be without any form, any activities, any thoughts. How long can you be happy? The advantage is no suffering, no birth. You know, that's fine. But how long can you stay like that? I am that I am. I'm not suffering. What kind of ananda is that? You know, I mean, it's something, but it's not fulfilling. You see, what I like to compare it to is: imagine it's the middle of July in New York. Okay, New York City. I don't know if you've ever been there. You know. It's hot, it's noisy, it's pollution, the buses are pouring out. You know, you're walking down Broadway and you have an appointment, you know, at a certain time. But it's just so hot and so you need some relief. So you duck into a movie theater, lobby, okay? And it's air conditioned and it's quiet, you know, and suddenly, what a relief, you know? And so you stand there, and then, you know, you get a little curious looking at the posters, the movies that are coming, whatever, you know. But if you don't actually pay your, you know, get a ticket and go and sit in the movie, you're going to eventually, the relief you felt is that, well, okay, but I still got to get to my appointment. And so you come out back into the city and you face all the noise and you have to go. You see what I'm saying? So that lobby is I compare it, it's kind of a crude example, is like the Brahmajyoti. It's the relief. You know? Oh, what a relief. Oh, I'm in heaven. But no, you know, there's so many things to do. And if you don't, you know, commit yourself and go into Goloka Vrindavan, commit, it's a bad analogy. If you're not a devotee, then you come back down again. And that's what this verse is. Even though by great austerities, a few may rise up to the Brahman platform, you know, the soul is a person. We want activities and relationships and so forth. So relief from misery is not enough. That's a false ananda. Another example Prabhupada would give. Imagine a graph, okay? A graph. So The y-axis is the vertical one, is happiness, bliss. And the x-axis is time. Okay? Time. So in our ordinary life, we exist below zero on the y-axis. We're miserable. But then with a little effort, we get a little closer to the zero point. We think, oh, now I'm happy, I'm enjoying it. And then we get again misery going down like that. Now the impersonalists, they can, if they get free of the body, basically, and they come to the Brahman, they get up to the zero point. And they think, oh, I'm in bliss. Brahmananda, you know. But they haven't even begun to experience real ananda, which is above the zero point in the, you know, positive, which devotees experience. You know what I'm saying? So sense gratification is very insignificant. But it's compared to a little drop of water compared to Brahmananda, which is at the zero point. But Premananda is positive, infinite, you see? So the Brahmananda is like a drop of water in the ocean of Premananda. So just becoming free of misery is not fully satisfying to the soul. And in order to have at least some relationships and activities, you'll come down again and open some hospital or something. You know, like that's the idea. So that's the general fate. You don't stay up there eternally, maybe a long time, but eventually you come down. It's like, Maharaj, you had a comment or a question? I'll give you up to end.
Even devotees will take on suffering because that suffering is a form of enjoyment because it's devotional service.
Yes, yes. It's like a mother will sacrifice for the happiness of the child. And that, you know, that effort is part of their expression of love. And she feels happy doing it, you know, performing so many sacrifices. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote a song like that. If there is some difficulty in your service, that difficulty is the greatest of my happiness. You know, provided that the love is flowing, and you say, "Oh, this is a chance for me to really show more love for my Lord." You know, and that's why real devotees they embrace difficulties. Vibhadaksantu takshashvat, you know, Kunti prays, let the dangers happen again and again because we'll see you. Or like our own Srila Prabhupada, you know, coming out, getting on that boat. I mean, that was incredible. You know, and in spite of having the heart attacks, in spite of everything, he stuck with it, you know. That's real expression of love. You know, so it means all glory to Srila Prabhupada. Hari Hari.